Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, June 23rd. I'm Catherine Alston Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, the second part of Unpacking Financial and Investment Advice. Last week, we talked about financial advice, and it was more focused on personal finance and financial planning. And this week, I'm going to talk about and focus on investment advice. But first, our theme in money and markets. On Ask Catherine, if I don't get you your questions in general or on the financial and investment advice this week, I'll make sure to roll it up and address it in the first week of July because I want to make sure I get, on this topic in particular, all of your questions addressed and handled. Theme. The theme tonight is the military is assigned to clean up behind the elephant. We all know that image of what it means to clean up behind an elephant. And it's something we saw happen to the military in Vietnam. The money guys made a whole bunch of money, and all the guys who made the decisions were long gone. And then the military was stuck with sort of cleaning it up. I remember when I was in the Bush administration, there was a general counsel at HUD who argued that we should abrogate a whole bunch of contracts to the co-insured lenders. And he argued, so somebody said, well, you know, they could sue us because we do have contracts and we'd be breaking the law, we'd be abrogating our contracts. And he said, who cares, by the time they win, we'll be long gone. So what he meant was they'd get a lot of political capital for doing it and, you know, their allies would make money and then phew, they'd be gone. So the military is left cleaning up the elephant, and the part of the elephant is the politics of the budget for our military operations in Libya, Afghanistan, and Iraq, and sort of spreading through the Middle East. I talked before about the Bilderbergers implying that there'd be an expansion into Libya, but this week we were seeing just screaming about the budget and what it means. Gates retiring from defense, he's using his retirement as an opportunity to pit the military budget. He calls them entitlements. Referring to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. He doesn't seem to be realizing that people have been paying a lot of cash into Social Security, which has been financing the military budget all along. We've made military commitments that have used a whole bunch of money for a whole lot of private interests that many would argue are in the national security. But if you look at sort of the profit margins for defense contractors, private companies, it's never been a sustainable plan for the U.S. government. So the military is going to get hung with the end game just as they did in Vietnam. Some interesting history here because the Clintons were very instrumental, Gates says, in not properly keeping the military funded. And Hillary Clinton was in the Clinton administration was roundly criticized by Congress for the amount of technology transfer and other things into China. And, of course, many of you have heard my theory that the HUD missing money got laundered out to investment in Asia, including in China. So now we see the military sending troops to the Middle East and putting forth an effort in Libya to keep the Chinese out. If you listen to Jim Norman and the oil cards, he talked a lot about our need to checkmate the Chinese in the control of Eurasia and the sort of the pipeline routes and the natural resources there. So we're seeing Americans who lost their home, and that's not unrelated to the money that disappeared out of HUD, now sending their sons and daughters to protect American interests in places that are threatened by the national security interests of a Chinese machinery that was financed with their foreclosures and pension funds, and the Clintons were right in the middle of that. So the circle's getting tighter and tighter, and as we come into election year, there's a lot of dirty laundry underneath that, and it's not going to be surprising to see it come out. And so we talked earlier several months ago about it wasn't surprising when Hillary Clinton's name got floated for Secretary of Defense. It wasn't long before she got her head handed to her. And for that matter, Newt Gingrich, who had the lack of judgment to suggest she would make a good secretary. Gingrich had little chance to become the Republican nominee, but he certainly had little chance. It's very hard for a Republican to win the Republican nomination without the support of the defense establishment. So why he stuck his foot in his mouth there, I don't know. You all know that I keep working on this list of the best books for the 21st century. One book you absolutely want to read, if you want one of the books that's going to be on the list, is one called Trading with the Enemy. The subtitle is The Nazi-American Money Plot, 1933 to 1949, by Charles Higham. You can get it. You know, it's fairly easy to get. It's up on Amazon. And it tells the story of how the same financial interests financed the Nazis and the Americans during World War II. There are many other stories about the extent to which that money was sort of laundered back, and including with the Nazis, into America after the war. And there are some historians who take the position that the Nazis won the war, if you look at the economics of it. But put that aside, it's Higgins' book and Black's book on IBM and the Holocaust are two great examples of why, you know, in many respects, we've always had the, you know, the best enemies that money could buy, but it was our money who bought them. And so we come back now to American interests not financing the Nazis, but financing the Chinese, who we then have to turn around and control with the oil card and the war in the Middle East. So if there's not enough money for Social Security, if my suspicions about the missing money from HUD and DOD are true, then it's because we, you know, we emptied some of that money out to finance the enemy that is now emptying out the Treasury yet again. So there's a sort of, there's an ugly backdrop behind here that gets to the heart of the red button problem that we've talked about many times before. If you're interested in the missing money stories, just do a search on the search engine for missing money plus Solari.com, and you'll pick up our missing money page. Many, many stories of literally hundreds of billions of dollars, well, trillions, because 3.3 trillion went missing from the Department of Defense. Now, not surprisingly, we see the stories about the billions that have disappeared in Iraq, major reports of incredible fraud. These stories continue to dribble out this week and last week as the budget fights get meaner. And it wouldn't surprise me as the cutbacks continue to gore lots of oxes, that we're going to see more dirt leaking out as the different factions kind of leak the dirt on each other. Very interesting. The U.S. mayors got together and voted a resolution at their annual, it's the U.S. Conference of Mayors at their annual meeting, voted Monday in favor of a resolution calling on Congress to wind down the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's a pretty compelling development, because the mayors, even though municipal, state, and local governments are in a weaker position, the mayors are not without consequence in this situation. So one of the things that the military, if you look at the breakdown of the federal budget by state, the military and military contracts and military purchases are the biggest part of all of the sort of government money running into a place, and very, very important to state and local economies and state and local government budgets. And as the military has moved abroad, essentially what's happening is the soldiers are eating at the Halliburton Cantina instead of at sort of Waffle House and Dossie's Grill on Main Street. And so, you know, I think the mayors understand the importance if that army comes back and is located in their state and local area, because they've seen tremendous drain of federal government dollars as those dollars move abroad and out of states in the country. So keep watching as this budget fight goes on, because a lot is going to fall to the military to kind of manage the end game on this, and I suspect it's going to become an increasingly painful process as they have to take responsibility on the ground. Money and markets. The effort to bring down the price of commodities and to strengthen the dollar continued with the IEA, the International Energy Agency, announcing the release of 60 million barrels. We saw, of course, then the oil prices just take a swan dive, followed by the market, the equity markets taking a swan dive. Precious metals down, but seem to rally at the end of the day. So there seems to be an awful lot of strength there. Given the drop in oil prices, the problems in the finance sector coming out from the Greece negotiations and woes in the sovereign debt markets, you know, there's more than enough bad news, especially on top of summer. So, but then we have Ben Bernanke indicating that there will not be a QE3 starting on June 30. So the Fed is kind of standing off to the sidelines. And as I said last week, I think they're working on building the political consensus to do a QE3, but it's not going to come before there's plenty of pain. And, of course, oil down, the equities markets down. We're seeing, you know, in asset prices, a deflationary spiral that's going to get some relief from the pain caused by rising energy and food prices globally that was coming from the rise in commodities. So relief in that way and relief for people who like a rising dollar. But I continue to wait to see what happens at the Grove and see what happens on the debt deal before the Congress recesses on August 5th. So I think we're going to see a QE3. I just think there's a question of how much pain we're going to get, and they're going to be very heated negotiations for a few more weeks. So watch. Another thing to watch is the Greek privatization. There are several excellent comments in the blogosphere that I put up on the blog this week. A lot of them talking about, you know, watch out. What they're doing to Greece is just a precursor of what they're going to do here. Now, I think they're going to be a little bit more subtle here than they're being in Greece. But we also saw a call saying, oh, you know, if Greece has a default, it's going to ripple and default the whole world and destroy the financial system. Well, that's a bunch of hooey. Again, remember, debt is a control system. It's not a finance system. There's no reason why the powers that be would give up their control system just because they weren't able to get what they wanted in one place. So now it does mean for the guys who are managing the system in the middle, you know, all sorts of musical chairs and problems and scramble. So if you're, you know, if you're the German chancellor, I don't mean to underestimate the pain of this process for you. But it's really going to be very ugly. It's funny, there's been plenty of spin that Greek workers aren't, you know, the Greek people are lazy and live on tons of government money. I'm going to put up in the blog this weekend the OECD labor report. It turns out the average German works 1,300 hours plus a year. The average American, 1,700 hours plus a year. And the average Greek worker, 2,100 hours a year. So doesn't sound to me like the Greeks are just sitting around on government money. A new comment from the U.S. News that says Republicans are going to focus on the economy in the 2012 elections rather than social issues. That's not surprising if, given the candidates that seem to be stepping forward. But I continue, you know I keep beating this drum to y'all, but I continue to keep getting all sorts of messages and communications from both clients and subscribers who are getting sucked into cultural wars around race, religion, and sex. And so my warnings don't seem to be doing any good. But for some reason, smart people just don't see this game. So I keep telling people, look, collaborate on the money and hate each other rich instead of hating each other poor. So don't fall into the divide and conquer stuff if you can avoid it. For a great example of how the cultural wars relating to sex have been used to build the train tracks of control, you should take a look at Tom Ball's very long suicide letter. Tom Ball was a gentleman who, after many years of frustration in the family courts in New Hampshire, walked up last week, sat down in front of the courthouse in New Hampshire, poured gasoline on himself, and lit himself with a match. Now, you know, considering the extremity of this, particularly in this country, it is amazing that you rarely saw it anywhere on the media. If you read his suicide letter, it's quite long. It's about 20 pages, but it has some remarkably insightful comments on how family law and regulation has been used in ways that very few people understand to be very, very damaging. And if you want to know what's wrong with the economy, go read Tom Ball's letter, and it will describe a slice of it to you. But you've got to see through the section and, you know, aspects of the culture war that's been played. Anyway, but I recommend it to you. Believe it or not, the FTC is looking into whether Google abuses its dominant of Internet search to extend its influence. So, you know, its searches tend to bring up links that steer you back to its site as opposed to its competitors. My attitude is we're coming into a campaign. If you look at how many companies can profit from a loss of market share by Google, I would think an antitrust investigation coming into next year's election would be great for campaign fundraising. Google and all of its folks will have to defend, so they're going to have to buy Congress, and the competitors who want to get new rules are going to need to buy Congress, and Congress is going to be right in the middle. So good for fundraising, but so let's see what the Department of Justice does. Solari Hero of the Week is Marcy Kaptur, that wonderful congresswoman from Ohio. I sent her $100 this week and put up a post on the blog recommending her for your campaign contributions. The woman has the guts of a Spartacus. If you look at the video on the blog, it speaks for herself, but she was trying to compare the largesse of Congress to the banks with their incredible nerve of basically, you know, taking food from children. Anyway, I recommend it to you. My Solari Hero of the Week is not Rick Perry, who's the governor of the state of Texas. Believe it or not, somebody started to circulate a video this morning proposing a dream team for the campaign of Perry as president, Catherine Austin Fitz as vice president. And so I just wanted to assure you I have nothing to do with that. I have no idea where it came from, but the chances of me running for political office are exactly 0%. Okay, so questions are going to be addressed in our feature today, so no Ask Catherine and no Let's Go to the Movies. We're going to dive right in because we've got plenty to talk about. Unpacking Financial Investment Advice, Part 2, Investment Advice. As I said last week, we spoke about personal finance and financial advice, so if that's your interest, I really encourage you to go back in the archives and get it. And a lot of what I said last week will dovetail with what I say today about investment advice. Now, before I start, I just want to make sure I'm transparent about my conflicts of interest. It's always important when you listen to anybody, whether on the media or in business, you need to understand how their money works and what their financial incentives are, because our financial incentives help to define our point of view. So it's really important you understand how somebody makes their money. And since I make my money as an investment advisor, I want to make sure you understand sort of what my business is. So as you listen to me talking about my point of view, you can anticipate and decide if you think there are any potential conflicts of interest. I have two businesses. One is the Solari Report, where I work essentially to add value to subscribers. And then the second, I'm an investment advisor. I have a company, Solari Advisors, which is registered in Tennessee and then in several other states. And we have a disclosure statement also filed in New Zealand. And Solari Advisors provides essentially consulting services. We do not take responsibility for actively managing money. So we're just providing consultation to families. It's really to individuals and families and their related trusts and businesses. And we're working with other investment advisors and a variety of other financial institutions to help them do that, or they're doing it themselves with discount brokers. And then we have recently started a new company, Sea Lane Advisory, that is a partnership between Solari Advisors and Financial Perspectives, which is an investment advisor in Pleasanton, California. I'm working out of their offices for a three-month period, so that's why I've been talking to you from California. And Sea Lane was started because I was increasingly having trouble finding a balanced fund investment strategy operation that I could trust. And so I simply decided to start it with an investment advisor who I do trust. And so now we're actively making money, and that company is operational, and we're registered in California. So my point of view is building family wealth, and I very much believe that if you look at what makes a community healthy, if you look at what makes a state healthy, if you look at what makes a country healthy, if you look at what makes the planet healthy, a lot of it comes down to families who are successful in many ways, including financially, and through that financial success give back and bring real strategic governance and value to a place and to networks. And so I feel that one of the greatest dangers to communities and democracy and to our economy is families getting drained. And so it is very much my response to the corruption that I saw on Wall Street and Washington is, how can I help families navigate the change that we're going through and navigate and protect themselves from the corruption because the more family wealth that we can preserve and build in this environment, I think the much better off the world will be. So that's kind of my point of view and my take. My model is what I call the Salarian model, and when I came out of the Bush administration, I was really concerned. You know, I sort of came out and said, the fascists are going to kill us all. What can we do about it? And I spent years building relational databases and studying the economy and simulating what was happening. And I came to a conclusion that essentially we needed to change our investment model in a very, very simple way. You know, I was trained at the Wharton Business School and at Wall Street to believe that you needed to focus on optimizing your returns to investors. So you would invest in different things, and the goal of a good investment advisor was to make sure his investors had the highest possible returns. Well, that's all well, nice, and good in a world where the government is running around and making sure that all sorts of certain things are being taken care of. But when that's not happening, or government's being run as a criminal enterprise, of course, that just makes it worse because everybody's making money rigging government contracts as opposed to doing something that has economic value, or they're making money polluting and destroying the ecosystem rather than doing something that has fundamental value. So you get into this liquidation model where investors are making money, but the whole planet is being destroyed and sort of all the long-term value is being rubbed out of the economy. So what I looked at was I said, look, an investment has really two components. There's not just the return to the investor, but there's the pro forma impact on the entire financial and real ecosystem. So think of an investment as having two returns. One is the return to the total economy, which can be positive or negative, and then one is the return to the investor, which can also be positive and negative. And our goal should be to always have a positive towards both. And so my theory is, my goal as an investment advisor is still totally focused on getting a positive return to investors. But I use as a navigation tool my estimation of the total impact to the ecosystem of a particular investment. So when I look at investments, I don't just want to know about what their returns have been or what I think their returns are. I want to look at how much value they're adding to the total financial and environmental ecosystem. And I want to use that knowledge as a tool to identify both opportunities and risks. Now, people always say to me, well, this is really naive. No, it's not. Excuse me. If the pension funds had used this tool, and I was working with a group of pension fund advisors trying to get them to do this when I got interrupted by litigation, but if the pension funds, if the American pension funds had done this, they would not have financed the housing bubble. They would have not taken huge losses on Enron. The investors who took a huge loss on Madoff wouldn't have taken those losses. If you understand the impact on the total ecosystem, and in fact the impact on the total ecosystem is highly negative, what long periods of history show you is that in many cases, ultimately, the investors, you know, that comes back around and the investors end up losing their money. So it's this whole idea of estimating total ecosystem returns and understanding them has been very powerful as a risk management tool. So the difference between the traditional model and my model is, number one, I take the time to estimate the impact for the purpose of both identifying opportunities and managing risk. But the second thing I try and do is I have a rule, which is if I believe something has a negative total return to the ecosystem, I won't invest it. Now, what that means is if you offer me a double in Monsanto tomorrow, I won't take it for any amount of money. I won't do it. And that's because if you look at long periods of time, it has tremendous, and I'm not going to go into this in detail today, but it has tremendous benefit over time to both investment and business if you send a clear message about where your lines are. And if you hold to that line, it can have a very dramatic impact on who will play with you and how they will play with you. Another book I would recommend to you very strongly is The Evolution of Cooperation by Robert Axelrod, which ultimately does the best job I know of explaining why transparency is important to real solutions, not just to saving our world, but creating an investment system where everybody can make money, because we're in an investment system which is spiraling downhill, and it requires government money to prop it up. And the problem is not that a few people are consolidating the wealth into a few hands. The problem is, as they do it, they're shrinking the pie. And part of getting to real solutions is figuring out how to engineer things so the pie can get bigger for a lot of people, because then a lot of people are going to play. It's interesting, if you look deeply into a lot of people's personal portfolios, what you find is that they're financing the things they say they most hate, and they don't even seem to know it. And so this idea of learning over time how to look at the total ecosystem is one, and it's a learning journey, is very valuable, and it's something I hope to help you continually do in the Solari Report. Okay, so last week I had a series of sort of 9 takeaways from my experience over the last since 2004 working as an investment advisor. And so I have 10 tonight. I couldn't squeeze it in tonight, so we're going to do 10 takeaways, and let's just get rolling. Takeaway number one is a repeat of what I said last week, but I'm going to be really redundant on this because it is so very important. Takeaway number one is there is nothing more important in the investment world than the quality of the people you do business with. And I just can't repeat this enough. When you proceed to invest your money, there are a lot of things that can go wrong to the best people and the best ideas and the best of times. But what you find out is if you stick with very high-quality people, whether it's enterprises run by very high-quality people, investment operations or funds run by very high-quality people, you can ultimately avoid or get over a lot of the challenges that come that are just naturally going to come your way. So I think you can't be too careful. I said last week that people should be considered guilty until proven innocent. It's the opposite in the world of investment from the court of law. So I think you really have to be careful either to due diligence who you're doing business with, or make sure you're in business with people who will do that kind of due diligence. I'm always shocked when somebody says, well, I moved my CD from this bank to this bank because I can get a little bit more in an interest rate, when the first bank is run by very high-quality, capable people, and the second bank is run by people who I would have nothing to do with, and I certainly would never give them information about me or my data. All banks are not equal. All financial institutions are not equal. So price is not, you know, there should be certain things that disqualify people, and price can't get you back over that disqualification. Takeaway number two, again, is a repeat of last week, but it's even more important investments, and that is to please throw away your TV. The Wall Street Journal, I was inspired by the Wall Street Journal to say this again today. The Wall Street Journal had a survey on the front of the paper, A Day in the Life, How America Spends Its Time. The average American spends 8 hours and 23 minutes sleeping and 2 hours and 31 minutes watching television, up 5 minutes. The average American spends 4 hours and 24 minutes working, so we spend 50% of the time we spend working watching television. We spend 36 minutes on education. So if you look what you could do in a lifetime of cutting your TV time watching in half and spending that time learning about money or focused on enterprise, education, or investments, it's amazing to think what could happen. I just watched a documentary last night, which we will do in Let's Go to the Movies on Solari Report. I cannot recommend it to you enough. It's called A Man Named Pearl, and it's about a guy down in a sharecropper's son down in South Carolina who started an amazing garden, just amazing. It looking at it will bring you to tears. And he did it. He worked for 36 hours at a local plant, and he did it, you know, at nights. He came home and he worked on the garden instead of watching TV. And it's an incredible example of what can be done if you just turn off your TV. We talked last week about time and knowledge budgets, and I'm not going to repeat that here, but it certainly applies to creating the time to focus on investments. And so really sitting down and saying, okay, what do I want to learn and how do I want to learn it? And applying that to investments, very important to do. Takeaway number three, practice true diversification. There is something that some of you have heard about called modern portfolio theory. And modern portfolio theory has been used as kind of an invisible capital control to make sure you put a lot of your money into a brokerage account and then it ends up basically financing the military-industrial complex. And certainly in combination with sort of the other rules and regulations, it's been amazing at kind of channeling everybody back into the tapeworm. What's interesting is when you then look at your portfolio, what you'll find is that your portfolio is not diversified. In fact, if you look at, let's say, 10 mutual, you know, I used to look at portfolios. So we had 10 different fixed income or bond funds, and then we had 10 different equity funds, and we had some stocks and a variety of other things. And when you look through it, you had thousands of companies and governmental entities represented, and all of them depended on defense contracts, defense purchases, and derivatives thereof. And when you plowed back into that, that all depended on the U.S. Treasury borrowing money. So essentially what you had was a giant Treasury bond priced in lots and lots of different, you know, so the pricing related to the equity markets, to the fixed income markets, but essentially the whole portfolio was a bet that the U.S. Treasury could keep borrowing money and the military-industrial complex would work. And so, you know, that may be a good bet or that may be a bad bet. I let you decide, and I let you decide if that's what you want to put your retirement funds into financing, if that's the world you want to create. Some people would say yes, some people would say no. But what I would say is you need to be clear about that, but you also need to be clear that it's not diversified. It's in a U.S. financial system, and it's one big bet. Now, let's look at true diversification, and I have a very popular blog post called Financial Coup d'Etat, and then part two of that blog post, if you just do a search for Financial Coup d'Etat on the blog or on any search engine, you'll pull it up, and then part two is about true diversification, and it's a very good overview. So let's look at true diversification. True diversification is owning your own home, and particularly one that is structured. We talked about disintermediation last week, where you can reduce or cancel your utility bills or other maintenances. So you permanently, you invest your money not in things that produce a coupon or a dividend, but in things that permanently reduce your expenses. That's, you know, true disintermediation. You know, I always hear, well, if I put my money in a financial institution or in a brokerage account, I can get a higher yield than my after-tax cost of my mortgage. Well, yes, that's true if it all works. So if somebody had all their money, if we had Janine Roth talking about Lost in her book, Lost and Found, and losing all her money in Madoff, and one of the things she kept saying is, oh, I wish I had paid off my mortgage. And I didn't want to pay my mortgage off because I was making more money in Madoff than I was, you know, having to pay on my mortgage after tax. Well, that's a perfect example. True diversification means not necessarily trying to arbitrage everything between owning your own home and being in a financial institution. Owning things locally, so a good local bank. One of the things I've seen done very well is a local community loan fund. Local community loan fund, if it's well run, is really grounded in the local economy and can provide true diversification. I've seen community loan funds, which I thought would stand in a scenario where J.P. Morgan Chase went down, because they were so grounded in the real local community. Owning your own enterprise, very, very important. It's, you know, the market can fire you, but certainly the company won't if you own your own enterprise. Investing in your own skills, very, very important. If you know how to start and operate an enterprise, you may not want to do it now. You may want to do something else, but you have those skills. And so I look at this survey of 2.5 hours on TV and only 36 minutes on education, and it chills me because when the economy is changing like this, it is unbelievably important to invest in skills, not just skills that can generate an income, but skills that can we can do for ourselves, because it makes so much more sense, given the tax picture and inflation, to do things for ourselves. I've talked about stockpiling non-perishables, owning precious metals, or investing globally. If you want to read more about this or learn more about this, I would really recommend the audio seminar, the audio seminars in the Investor Collection, including the Positioning Your Assets for Growth in Uncertain Times. So don't think that diversification is simply buying stocks in a lot of different functional areas, all that are part of the same system financed by the U.S. Treasury. Practice true diversification, which is really not just going through big financial institutions, whether you're in North America or Europe and Asia, but things that really do, in the kind of different scenarios that can happen, give you true diversification. Takeaway number four, stick to the long-term trends. I talked about this last week as well. Do not try to outtrade the insiders. Now, if you're an insider, if you have a flow of great insider information, fine. But what I've seen so far is we have a highly managed economy. It is remarkably sort of played by the big financial institutions. We've seen lots of stories about, sort of Goldman front-running or people front-running the market. It is very difficult to short-term trade and out-trade a rigged game, especially when you don't have the resources to do it. Now, what is possible is to understand the fundamental long-term trends and to stick with them, because even in a managed economy, fundamental economics matter. Now, I referred you to our year-end wrap-up that we did in January. We did a wonderful transcript. I recommend it to you because it'll certainly go through some of the long-term trends, but let's focus on some of them. One is the shift from paper assets to tangibles. So that's one of the reasons I so focus on precious metals. It's one of the most liquid and easiest to invest in the tangible group, and certainly precious metals has really performed very nicely. In some respects, it really hasn't gone up in value. What we're watching is a drop in the dollar and other fiat currencies, but it certainly protected us in a lot of ways over the last 5 years. Trend number two is globalization, especially following the demographics. We see economies that are growing and rising and very much tracking both the rise of the middle class in those places and the average age of the population. And that trend is going to continue no matter, sort of all the different pain caused by the rise in the cost of commodities, et cetera. So globalization going to keep happening. Number three is managed economy. If you can see the deeper game in a highly managed economy, there's a lot you can do to protect yourself and to find opportunity, but it's very, very important to see the covert side of the economy. And then number four is new technology. So all four areas present serious, serious opportunities. That's not to say that there aren't serious risks. The biggest one is environmental risk. And I think I have never seen or found a way to seriously take advantage of enterprises that can heal the environmental risks by going through the financial system or the brokerage system. So far, I've seen most of the things we can do to try and protect ourselves from environmental risks are things we can do in our own household or personally or in our local area. I don't underestimate the importance. It'd be wonderful if we could start to find ways of doing it in our investments as well, but that time has not yet come. If it does, it's also going to be a tremendous opportunity. Let's just hope we get there. Takeaway number five, our primary investment risk is debasement. Now, there are two kinds of debasement I want to talk about. One is debasement of currency, and the other is debasement of quality, including standards and codes. So let me go through currency first. I did a series of posts, in the audio seminar, Positioning Your Assets for Growth in Uncertain Times, which was done in 2008, and then up on the internet and on the audio seminars is Navigate the Falling Dollar, which was done in 2004. And both of them describe the risks of debasement. I also did two blog posts off of those where I took the chart that I did in positioning your assets for growth in uncertain times, and I showed two investments. One was an investment in a fixed income investment, so it could have been a bond, a CD, from January 1, 2003 to January 1, 2008. And I said, okay, let's say we put $10,000 in a CD or bond in January 1, 2003, and we earned 5% a year, and then at the end we got our $10,000 back. Well, that sounds successful, right? But let's say we also put our money in precious metals at the beginning of 2003, and at the end, you know, we'd get a capital gain, and we have to pay usurious taxes because your taxes are more in precious metals. And after it was over, we had about $17,000 instead of $10,000, including getting the 5%, which we liquidated along the way. So I said, okay, well, with our $10,000, how much could we buy in terms of gallons of gasoline? And it turned out our $10,000 in 2008 could only buy half the gallons of gasoline that we could buy in 2003. And our precious metals could buy about the same gallons of gasoline. So all we'd done is hold even after taxes and precious metals, but we'd lost half of our purchasing value because we'd stayed in the dollar. So in two blog posts, I calculated that out for an entire household and then for a community of 100,000 people. And so what I discovered was that the household in that five-year period had lost about $250,000 of 2008 purchasing value, and the community had lost about $3.3 billion of purchasing power. And that's what I call debasement. That's the drain that everybody's feeling financially because we are keeping so much of our assets in dollars while they're going down in value. Now, one of the things that tricks us into doing that is a lot of people are focused on getting a current yield. And so they tend to go into things that's going to give them a current yield, and as they, or a guaranteed current yield, and as they do that, so precious metals gives you no yield. But let's say you go into something that gives you even a 5%. So let's say you go into a high-yield bond fund that gives you 5%. Well, you know, you end up losing half your purchasing value, so you're far worse off because you've gone into the yield trap. And if you listen to the audio seminar, Positioning Your Assets for Growth, in uncertain times, I go into the yield trap even more. But beware the yield trap, and beware the yield trap that sucks you into really getting debased. Because in the current environment, that is our number one risk. And it's particularly painful because as, let's say, we protected ourselves with precious metals, we get taxed on inflation, not true real profits when you look at it after inflation. So it's very, very painful, but it is what it is. But it's very important that you look at your investment in terms of your purchasing power, not just in terms of always translating it back into dollars. Now, within this category of debasement of the currency, it leads us to the problem with many insurance products and annuities. Many of these products are what I call forced savings plan. They run several risks, but one is that they're a long-term bet on the large financial institution you're doing them with, and two is that they're a long-term bet on the U.S. dollar. So depending on the length of them, you're betting the dollar is going to be strong for a long, long time. And unless you assume that, it's really not a good investment. Now, some of them over time have started combining, say, an annuity with mutual funds that give you some inflation protection. The problem is that those mutual fund choices can significantly limit your choices and control relative to what you could do away from them. So if you're going to one of these products, it's essential that it's a company that you're confident in, that it's going to be there for 20 to 30 years, that you've got an inflation protection built into it, and you understand sort of the control you're giving up relative to what you could do away from that. Another point in this area is I've seen many, many people ignore the dangers of debasement because they are so focused on the end of the world scenarios. And, you know, I've seen people now who for 15 years are fretting about the end of the world and completely not taking the actions they need to do to protect themselves against debasement. And as I've said before, the odds of the slow burn, the slow burn is here. It's now. You're being debased right now. This is not a risk. It's a reality. So you need to protect yourself from that, and it would be foolish to invest your time and resources to protect against the end of the world and not protect against debasement. Because debasement is, you know, people are always saying, I'm worried that they're going to steal my gold. Wait a minute, if you look at debasement, they're stealing a lot more money right now from your total assets. So you need to be worried about what they're stealing today invisibly, not just, you know, what they might come along and steal your gold. Okay, the second, debasement of currency is something, thanks to Ron Paul and much of the financial blogosphere, we've gotten much more savvy about. What we're less savvy about generally, and it's really important to be savvy about, is the debasement of the quality of the product. So one of the ways you sort of hide the debasement of currency from people is by debasing the product or the asset instead of changing the price. And so, you know, you keep charging them $100 for that stock, but when in fact that stock is no longer a worthy enterprise, it's been gutted, you just, it's been out the back door, you know, just like the off-balance short deals they did at Enron. Now, this debasement of quality issue is one of the reasons I focus so much on the kinds of things we've been talking about, like the smart meters with and sort of the dangers of cell phone and other technology that I've been talking about with Blake Leavitt. So the value of your house is not going down, but what you don't realize is the smart meter and the cell phone tower means that the safety and the health of that house is being debased as we speak. You're just not realizing it, and it hasn't shown up in the market prices yet. One of the biggest expenditures we all have in our life is our utility bills. But if you look at what's happening with dirty electricity and what's happening with fluoride and other chemicals in the water, you know, we're paying a great deal of money and not getting the quality that we think we're supposed to be getting. I mean, if you look at how much Americans spend on plastic and bottled water, when they're also paying their municipality to provide water, it's a double charge, and it's ridiculous. We're also paying much more for plastic and bottled water than we're paying the municipalities to run water systems. It makes no sense. Ditto with food packaging and GMOs. So rather than the price of the can of tuna fish going up, the can just gets smaller and smaller and smaller while the price stays the same, or there's more and more water in the can, or in fact the food is now genetically modified and is no longer nutritious. So the nutritional content is going down, 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 down. And so the debasement doesn't just always show up in price. It can show up in quality, and that's true. One other one I wanted to mention is, you know, we pay for software, but then suddenly we find our software has a trapdoor to the NSA, and we have absolutely no privacy. It's, in fact, we're paying in two ways. One is, you know, by providing private data, including financial data, and the other is by paying for the software. We're not getting what we think we're getting. But it's also happening with investments, as you know. So we see John Paulson, one of the biggest hedge fund operators, last week taking a $750 million write-down on Sinoforest, and more reports of Chinese stocks with huge losses from major fraud. You know, it's almost like they decided to get us back for Lehman's and the mortgage fraud. But very, very significant fraud. So you buy an investment which you think is legitimate, and it turns out not to be. And Paulson is, you know, to defraud Paulson for $750 million, that's quite some, you know, it's not like they're not sophisticated investors capable of doing serious due diligence. And that's why it's very, very important whether you're doing the due diligence or somebody is doing it for you, and then the monitoring to follow it that you watch, because the debasement is not just in the currencies. It's also in the assets, and it's not just at any particular time. It can be over time in ways that can be quite sneaky. One of the things that most concerns me, and I keep coming back to this, so I'm going to be redundant about this, is there are numerous newsletters and members of the blogosphere who get you to believe that collapse is literally only weeks or months away, and they're very, very persuasive. And one of the things that happens is when the collapse doesn't happen, they never stop to discuss, well, wait a minute, how come we were wrong? And one of the things I love about my partner at Sea Lane, Chuck Gibson, is he always says, what if we're wrong? And then, you know, well, wait, let's do a lessons learned. Why did that come out differently than we thought it would? But they never stopped to discuss why the collapse that they predicted didn't happen. You know, it didn't happen the last three times they predicted, and yet here they are predicting it again. So remember, that is a serious distraction to your understanding your real day-to-day risks that are upon you now, and debasement is the big one. And so I would really encourage you to get away from the more sort of adrenaline-stimulating stuff of collapse and, you know, get back to the hard work of protecting yourself against debasement of both currency and quality of product and asset. Takeaway number 6, learn to manage volatility. All the investments that can protect you, that have protected you against debasement, are volatile, and that's not an accident. Precious metals, natural resources, new technology, emerging markets, they're all volatile. The more people want to shift their money into them, the more the system manages them in a way that's volatile, and that has a way of forcing retail out of them and back into same old, same old. And so part of successful investment in this environment is learning to live and manage volatility intelligently and learning to avoid, you know, we tend to think of speculative things as volatile and real investments as not volatile. Well, this kind of sort of market management is getting very prudent and intelligent investments to look speculative from volatility. So please don't, you know, futures are as crazy and as dangerous to the retail investor as they've always been. That's highly speculative if you're not hedging your corn crop. But there are lots of investments that now are looking volatile. But if you look at their long-term returns, you can either be debased or you can live with volatility. And so I would really encourage you to think a lot about how to manage and live with volatility. The Wall Street Journal had a great and very interesting investment survey from one of the big firms on Generation X. And Generation X said that what they most wanted was the capital value of their portfolios to go up, but they didn't want volatility. And I looked at it and I said, you know, I empathize with your position, but you're going to get played. So if you look at Janine's story in Lost and Found, what she said was, you know, Madoff offered certainty. What you got was something that brought steady returns, and it never lost money. And you know, there was a certainty with that. And I will say one of the greatest needs in the human race that fraud plays on is the desire for certainty. And so Madoff is a very important lesson to learn, and Janine's book and our interview on the Solera Report is very useful, because beware certainty. In a world where we are literally a great deal of time and money is spent to prevent us from understanding the system and how things really, you know, work, and where economics matter, and in a world of 6 billion people, you know, things change, and certainty is a complete illusion. If you want to learn how to manage successful investment, you have to be willing to embrace uncertainty and view uncertainty as your friend. That's part of learning to manage volatility. The advantage of focusing on long-term fundamentals is you can value and you know what you're in and what it's worth. So you have to learn to see real prices and value in a market where the prices are phony because they're being manipulated, and they're being manipulated to attract and manage you in ways that are not in your best interest. Franklin Sanders on the Precious Metals Report always says, measure your wealth in hooves, ounces, and acres. You know, the way Warren Buffett has said it, not that I'm a big admirer of Warren Buffett, is, you know, if it's like a poker game, if you've been in the game for more than 20 minutes and you don't know who the fool is, then you're the fool. If you don't know the value of your stock and you let the market tell you, then you're going to be the patsy in the game. Takeaway number 7, keep taxes and losses in perspective. Some of the biggest mistakes I see people make is a failure to get out at the right time because of taxes. So you've been in something, you've gotten a big gain, you don't want to leave it because you don't want to pay the taxes. Well, let's say in 10 times, 2 times out of 10, it makes sense to let the taxes to stay in for a tax reason, but oftentimes it's time to take your losses and go. And so don't be afraid. A lot of people lost a lot of money in 2008 because they didn't want to pay the taxes on their gains. And, you know, by the time they got out, they didn't have to pay the taxes on the gains because they didn't have any gains. So beware taxes. I have a general rule that I will never make an investment or not make an investment or not sell because of taxes. Taxes should be a secondary decision in most cases, although not all. It shouldn't be the primary. The failure to get out because of a loss is another. Let's say I bought a stock at 20 and that stock's at 10. The most important thing for the performance of my assets is how's it going to do for the next year. So just because you haven't taken a loss doesn't mean you haven't had a loss. You know, it's 10. You lost your 10 bucks, and now you've got $10 of value. You can either hold it if you think over the hold period it's going to outperform anything else you could do with that 10 bucks. If you know something that's going to outperform, well, take your loss and move it into that thing. Because just like today is the first day of the rest of your life, today is the first day of the rest of your investment horizon, and there is no point in staying in something until it comes back if you can make more in something else. So don't fall into the pitfall of failing to take a loss when the time has come to take it. At the same time, beware emotional attachments. So for many of us, precious metals has done very, very well, but a day will come when it probably makes sense to sell a very large portion of our precious metals. And at that time, that's what we need to, you know, we need to move on. These are investments. They're not family members. There's a difference. Takeaway number 8, beware central controls and dirty tricks. Now, this is something I talk about a lot on the Saleri Report, so I'm not going to belabor all of it, but let me hit some of the high points. The economy right now is much more centrally controlled and engineered than most people appreciate it. And that central control is engineering incredible change. And as that change happens, you know, as one system comes down, the next system hasn't really come up. And in the process, a lot of things can fall apart and a lot of people can get hurt. Now, one of the things that's happening is there are more and more capital controls being put. It depends on where you are and what place you are. It's different in North America than it is in Europe. North America right now, the capital controls are probably the worst of anywhere. So, for example, if you go to a brokerage account and try and buy a foreign stock or a foreign bond, the broker will come to you and if he's honest, confess that he's got to mark those as speculative within the system. So if I want to buy a Norwegian sovereign bond, which is arguably the from a credit rating standpoint, the highest quality bond in the planet, you know, their wealth fund could pay off all their debt tomorrow in a snap, and they've got unbelievable oil reserves, it's got to be marked as speculative within the U.S. brokerage system. Well, that's an invisible capital control because it has all sorts of implications for different accounts, and it excludes it from all sorts of different accounts. And those invisible capital controls are getting, you know, are layering on more and more and more. And they really restrict capital flows for many people. And they really kind of keep forcing you back into the same old, same old. And it's another argument for disintermediation. Because it's through disintermediation. I told a story last week of telling somebody who's complaining about their water bill going up and the yields on their stock portfolio going down. I said, look, just sell stocks and build a well. This is simple. That's disintermediation. So you know, paying off your mortgage and rather than leaving the money in a brokerage account. That's disintermediation. So the more capital controls the financial institutions put on, the better the economics of disintermediation work. IRAs and 401ks, I've talked a tremendous amount about these. Make sure you have plenty of money outside these vehicles and understand what could happen with them. We have a couple of posts on the blog on IRAs and 401ks and a very good piece that I had David Lichty write for us, special report on the proposals for changes to 401ks and IRAs that occurred during the election period in 2010 that scared me to death. I don't think those are going to come up until we have the big debate about Social Security, probably in 2012 or 2013. But we do run the risks that the tax benefits you get, which particularly if you want to trade actively, are very attractive. There's an argument to be made, so whatever the benefits are, they'll make sure to claw it back. So if there's a danger that money can get trapped into annuity kind of structure like what they've proposed, you just need to be careful that the amount of money you have in those vehicles is sort of what you're willing to have subject to those rule changes. That's, you know, if that means you need to take money out, that's not a 2011 problem is what I think, but it may come up in 2012 and 2013. So it's something you can expect me to watch very seriously here, and I do. Social responsibility. I think there are many people who want to make sure that their money goes into something that has a positive sort of return to the ecosystem. There are an awful lot of socially responsible mutual funds, and what I find is the result that they get in terms of social responsibility is no better than you can get for yourself just looking at your investments or looking at the funds that you buy, and I'll tell you quickly how to do that. Basically, we're centralizing the economy. What you want to do is you want to decentralize the economy, so look for investments that in your mind are decentralizing. Part of the problem with the socially responsibility funds is they tend to invest in people according to what they say, not as opposed to what they do. You know, so you see big investments in everything from J.P. Morgan Chase to Halliburton because of their official policy statements. So there's no real effort to look covertly at what these guys are doing on the covert side, which has to be done by estimation because obviously there's not enough money to try and prove these things out in a court of law. But it's fair to say if you look at what happened with the housing bubble, it's hard for me to argue that putting money in J.P. Morgan Chase is socially responsible or on the bailouts. So a little bit of your good sense, just looking at, okay, who do I think is a clean player based on what I know and who's decentralizing? So sticking with small caps, for example. But use your own good sense. Understand that when you put money in a government bond or a mutual fund that puts money in government bonds, you're basically financing the government policies of that government. So use your good sense as to whether you think that's socially responsible or not. But my feeling is that with your personal judgments, you will get a better result than you will going into many of the socially responsible mutual funds. And I don't mean to underestimate the effort those people have made or that group has made to try and be socially responsible, but for a variety of reasons, they keep getting squeezed back into the tapeworm. A bugaboo of mine was and one thing that inspired me to do this sort of two-part series on financial investment advice is what happened with the last run-up on silver. We had sort of two groups. One was the gold bugs and the Sprout firm that had put together a silver ETF, really promoting higher silver prices. What I saw in the background, I would say, was a manipulation of the price up. And a lot of if you listen to a variety of the different radio stations that were internet radio that was covering this, you know, they were describing a squeeze in the market that I didn't see in the physical market at all. And I have to say, I think this was a manipulated pump as much as the suppression of the gold price during the 90s. So what I saw was sort of a pump and dump and one that I didn't think was done very nicely. And I think a lot of the effort to promote a higher silver price was irresponsible. Now, one of the people who promoted a higher silver price, who I like very much, is Max Kaiser. And I publicly said I thought Max's idea of crashing J.P. Morgan Chase wouldn't work. Franklin and I covered it on the Precious Metals Market Report. And then I got on the Max Kaiser show and debated it out with him. And here was the issue. What Max was saying is, let's squeeze J.P. Morgan Chase, which was managing big silver shorts and was managing the silver SLV ETF, which I'm not a fan of. If you read my article about the Precious Metals Puzzle Palace, which goes into SLV and the big gold ETF GLD, and you know what I said to Max is, look, I'm interested in helping people protect their assets. So a political agenda of talking everybody into buying silver to make life difficult for J.P. Morgan Chase is not investment advice. It's promotion of a political agenda, which is fine. It's fine to do that, but it's very important that investors understand that's not investment advice. That's something else. That's a political agenda. And if you want to use your money for a political agenda, that's fine, but don't think it's investment advice. And the same with Sprott. Sprott was promoting his silver ETF. And when the market hit the peak, he sold, as he said he was going to. But again, he's promoting his book. Now, somebody would say to me, there's nothing wrong with that. Absolutely not. But don't think that's investment advice. That's somebody who's developed an ETF. They're promoting their point of view. And, you know, they get it at the top because you've come in and helped move that stock up. So I think it's very, very important to understand where somebody's promoting their book or where they're promoting a political agenda, and that is very, very different than investment advice, because investment advice is supposed to be what's in your best interest given your unique situation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there are a lot of people who took a real nosedive on silver because they didn't anticipate the difference between promoting a book or promoting a political agenda and investment advice. Now, I say that, and I still believe silver is going to, you know, there's a very good chance silver is going to do quite well over the long haul. So if you got pumped and dumped on silver, don't worry. I think the long haul will dig us out of that particular sort of roller coaster ride. I talked last week about the use of entrainment in terms of marketing investments, including hedge funds, private equity, some social responsibility. And I won't go into detail it now, but you need to be very, very careful that when you are investing and you're using electronic communications, whether it's phone or video, you need to understand that these technologies exist, and you need to make sure that you are making your decisions with a very cool head. So you need to, as soon as you start to feel fear or greed or powerful resonation, you need to step back and make sure that you sleep on it and you think about it and you look at it with a cool head. One of the things I suggested last week is don't be alone. I have a Solaris Circle. It's a group of us who get together on phone. We have a little investment club, so a little partnership, and we invest together. But it's a group of people to talk things through. And so whether you partner up with other people to do investment, whether you put together a Solaris Circle or an investment club, whether you use an investment advisor, one or more, some people use a multiple, you know, think coolly, come from a clear mind, and if you're feeling fear or greed, watch out. Because that's these are the ways that you get hooked, and you don't want to come at these things from emotion. You want to test them out in very cool and ways and make sure whatever you're doing doesn't just pass the test of resonation, and it's just not in response to somebody pressuring you. It ultimately passes the test of a cool intellect who's looked at things from lots of different points of view. Takeaway number 9, if you use an investment advisor, find someone who is ethical, competent, and philosophically aligned. There are many ethical, competent people who may not be philosophically aligned with you. You want to make sure you're philosophically aligned. And I wanted to tell the story in that connection of a client. It's a perfect example. I have a wonderful client who's unbelievably thorough, And they, at the time, I wasn't managing money. I was just consulting. And he wanted someone in California where he lived, an investment advisor, to do the transactions. And so for years, I'd been looking for somebody in California, couldn't find anybody I trusted. And it was just hard because there were so many people who just didn't, you know, they wanted to drink the Kool-Aid. They weren't willing to face what was really going on. Anyway, so he went to the state regulator in California. You can go to your state regulator and you can identify. He identified all the independent firms in the San Francisco area and clearly understood the advantages of when you're with somebody who's associated with a large institution, often they're pressured to hoe the party line or push whatever the institution is pushing. So he knew he needed somebody who was independent. And he called it down to about 13 firms and then went and interviewed them all. So he called me up and said, you know, I've got this guy, Chuck Gibson. Could you check him out? So I checked him out, talked to him, and checked his references and really kept talking to him and was looking at his work. And I came back to him. I said, you know, this guy's absolutely fabulous. But this was a person who did a real search, and we're all the beneficiary of it now. But you want to do that. You want to take the time because this is a very important decision. You want to make sure it's somebody that you're very, very aligned with. In terms of sort of where you see the world going, and you're comfortable that they're philosophically aligned with you. And part of that is it's a managed economy, as I said, and so you want people who can do the fundamental and technical analysis that's required by economics and markets, but also the political and geopolitical analysis that's warranted by the political controls and the sort of greater governmental and sort of secret intervention in the economy. Okay, a quick roll-up of experts. I spent a lot more time talking about experts last week than I will this week, and that's because there are a lot of people I like on particular pieces. So there are fund managers I like on mining stocks or on natural resources or in particular parts of Asia. But it's very rare I find somebody that I trust to see the whole game and be competent and ethical to manage the whole full picture. And it's one of the reasons I started Sealane. I was trying to find a fund to replace one that I'd been using in Europe. And I couldn't find one. And so that's when I decided to gather a team who could do the kind of approach that I thought would, you know, I really needed. Now, they're insiders who know what I know, and they're insiders who have a team that could do what I'm describing. But the fact is I don't trust them to respect the rights of their investors. So I think they see the whole game, but I don't trust them to be honorable to their investors. You know, and I've given you plenty of examples, but the one I love is the guys who sold their business on the New Jersey ports, made more than $1 billion, turned around, put the money in Lehman, who particularly, you know, who lost a great deal of it right away. You know, it's right out of The Godfather, and you'd think that making $1 billion on the New Jersey ports would tell you you should never put all your money in one place, but I guess they couldn't translate what they learned on the ports to what was going on Wall Street. Another is the story we talked about recently about Goldman Sachs, you know, losing $1 billion plus for the Libya Wealth Fund, you know, in under a year, or the, you know, another example in 2008 is all the investors who lost money and put bonds in Enron and Madoff. I could go on and on. So there are plenty of insiders who have extraordinary information about what's really going on. At the same time, you know, I think you have to be very careful about playing with them. I got some questions on Jim Cramer, which really surprised me. It never occurred to me that Jim Cramer was giving investment advice. I just assumed everybody knew it was entertainment, but I never thought of it as investment advice. And, you know, I don't think of Jim Cramer as somebody who's watching out for your personal best interest. So I would take it as entertainment. And I think it's an entertainment. He's quite entertaining. I got some questions on Peter Schiff, who I think has a good approach to equities in the emerging markets. He understands. He's very focused on long-term value, and I think his sort of effort to take a long-term, almost Templeton kind of approach to what's going on in the emerging markets and how to approach that in a very conservative way. So I think Peter has some good takes. I don't always agree with him, but I think he's fundamentally fundamentally got a sound idea. A lot of questions on SRI. I addressed that earlier. I think SRI oftentimes is the Susie Orman of mutual funds. It makes you feel good and says all the right things and then channels you right back to the tapeworm. At the same time, I'm very sympathetic with a lot of good people in that industry because given the sort of invisible capital controls, it's very hard for them to not do that. It's very easy to fall into that trap. And that's why I think greater transparency can help change a lot of this. And if we get really serious transparency, both in the media and in the financial world, that industry could go in an extremely positive direction. Now, right now, it doesn't look like it's going that way. If anything, green, the whole green movement and sustainable looks like it's going to evolve into the next big scam, and quite the opposite is going to happen. But it's never over till it's over. But this is why transparency is so important, because I think there's a lot that industry could do to rock and roll if transparency really started to happen. Takeaway number 10. So let's talk about the big long-term opportunities, because there's some very big opportunities, and these are going to be very, very long-lived. Just as precious metals has been very long-lived, these are going to be very long-lived. One is new technology, which can be nice or not so nice. So nice is if we could unsuppress energy technology and healthcare technology and use it to address a lot of the aging issues and solve what are just terrifying environmental problems. There's a lot of very positive stuff that could go on, as everybody says, when should I sell my precious metals? Well, if Tesla energy becomes available, you probably want to get out of precious metals and get into certain kinds of equities pretty quickly. There's a lot of not-so-nice technology. We've talked about GMO, really frightening, and up on the blog I put up stories about the Japanese scientist who's figured out how to turn human excrement into food and lab-grown meats. It's frightening. The Yes Men, who I love, had a spoof pretending they're from the World Trade Organization and proposing we turn human excrement into hamburgers. I think they'd be appalled to realize that some scientist is really seriously trying to do this. It's important to remember in new technology, if you look back at recent stock market history, you know, gold has done well and precious metals has done well, but Indonesia beats precious metals and Netflix beats Indonesia. So new technology is always an area. It's tricky to figure out, but it's always an area of opportunity, particularly when we start to bring it to bear, not just on delivering you and I, you know, movies faster, but really addressing the real problems of the world. A second very important opportunity is trading places. Now, this one is deep, so hold on to your hat. If you look at how we've governed assets on planet Earth, we've had governments run places, so municipalities or states or counties or countries. And so places are managed by governments, and assets, enterprises, are managed by corporations. So corporations make technology, or they make weapons, or they distribute food. You know, so the functional areas have traditionally been corporations, and the places have been governments. Now, what privatization means at the root is we're going to start trading places. So more and more what you see, and you'll see this in the exchange-traded funds and in the mutual funds, is, you know, there's an ETF for Korea, and there's an ETF for Indonesia, and there's an ETF for China, and so more and more you literally can trade places. So you can, in theory, we're going into a world where you can go long London and short New York, and I suspect that's going to drill down. There's absolutely no reason why there shouldn't be a venture fund or a mutual fund for your county or for your state. In fact, we've seen a few people dabble and try to do these things, but what's going to happen more and more is we're going to start looking at places on an equity basis, and investments are going to start essentially optimizing and trading places. One of the things that's very important to this development is going to be transparency, because one of the reasons this hasn't happened, and there's several, is that governments have done a very good job of keeping the information you need to kind of map out your economic and financial ecosystem under wraps. So even though we vote for political representation within our congressional district and we spend a fortune in taxes and the government then spends a fortune in our congressional district, we can't see a financial statement for our congressional district, which if you're going to hold your representatives accountable in a democracy, that's the first piece of information you need. You know, you need to know, okay, well, you know, we put in this much taxes and this much money came around to our congressional district, and, you know, what happened? What was the performance? I mean, just like you need a financial statement for a company you put money into, you need financial statements for a government, and you need it contiguous to the areas that you walk around and see in the real world, because that's the ultimate financial control, when you can see a relationship between the roads that aren't working and the bridges that are falling down and where the money that went to the government went and why it didn't go there. So new technology and trading places, two enormous opportunities, very, very long-lived. And, of course, we've also, number three, we've talked a lot about big long-term opportunity is the switch from paper to tangibles. And those could be very, very impacted by these other two, both the new technology and trading places. So change is happening. You've all heard me talk about the central banking warfare model. The central banking warfare model is the fundamental investment model that this planet has been managed on for about 500 years, and that is the central banks print money, and then the military makes sure that other people take that money, and then they get natural resources back for cheap. And what we're watching globally is sort of the death of that model, because that model can't keep working. It's not sustainable, and for a variety of reasons. Unfortunately, we've created a financial mechanism that can print paper, which is worthless, and extract natural resources ad infinitum. And all around the world, you're seeing more and more people feel the pain of that and getting quite fed up with it. And it's not just countries that can't do anything about it. It's countries that have nuclear weapons and can do something about it. So not surprisingly, we've seen the market share of the dollar fall significantly in trade and in financial transactions. And so we're really looking at the end game of something that's been going on for very, very long. And that's the question we're talking about. That system is sort of coming apart and the new system is forming. And what we need to do in investment is manage our assets from the old system to the new system. And that's why I keep talking about positioning and repositioning. How do I kind of, you know, I feel like a squirrel and I need to pick up my nuts and transfer them from the tree that's falling down and get back over underneath the tree that's sort of growing. And it's tricky because when things come apart, the internal controls come apart and the risk skyrockets and the lawlessness skyrockets, and that's what we're all dealing with. I have a wonderful ally, Thomas Hupp, who is the head of marketing at the book publishing company at the farm in Tennessee. And he says something that I try to always remember when I sit back and I look at our investment system. And he says, you know, the bigger the breakdown, the bigger the breakthrough. And the reality is if we're going to change the model, which we have to do, then things have to come apart. And the opportunity for all of us is if we can protect our assets from that coming apart and get them, shift them over and get them on a diversified basis invested in helping the breakthrough, but in a way that's going to make money. One of my favorite quotes is from H.L. Hunt, and it's up on the blog. He says, if this country is worth saving, it's worth saving at a profit. And for to get to a sustainable model, it needs to be a financially sustainable model, which means it needs to have a return. And that's one indication that it is sustainable. So I don't estimate the potential cruelty of this change for many of the people who were not anticipating it or for a variety of reasons and no fault of their own cannot make the shift into the change. However, I don't underestimate the potential opportunities if you can and do. So just in closing this segment, I would say I wish you good hunting and good luck, because ultimately in investment, you know, a little bit of luck can help a lot. Okay, so as I said, no, let's go to the movies tonight. Obviously, I've gone on for quite a long time, and I thank you for your patience, but it's a long topic. We don't have a salary report next week, but then coming up in the first week of July, we have the second quarter wrap-up. So as you know, at the end of every quarter, I like to look back, and so I'll be sort of doing a bring-down of our year-end wrap-up. Then July 14th, we have the precious metals market report, and then July 21st, very good one, Scott Tipps, one of the leading experts on Codex, which is what I'm calling the global scheme to control your food. Very important thing to understand, and very important part of the sort of rules that are making for the geopolitics. So there's going to be a lot coming up. So until the first week of July, have a wonderful July 4th weekend. I won't speak to you before then. And until then, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you definitely need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.